3, 2, 1, play.
The following conversation.
Let's start again.
Okay.
You're a little bit ahead. Okay. Let's try.
Okay. Set. 3, 2, 1, play.
The following conversation was taped at my home in Blacksburg on July 20th, 1992.
To me, art's specialness is still a subcategory of separation. I think we need everything to become holy or numinous. Everything has to be equally holy. The mountain, the ant, the person, the blade of grass, the dinner, the sky. One trouble I have with art right now is how it isolates certain moments or certain acts. If you're really living utterly in tune with the life energy, every single moment and every single event becomes numinous. And that's something that we've lost, that art supposedly addresses and tries to bring back.
How has that attitude influenced you to stop making art and to burn or to give away your sculptures? Do you want to give me the scoop on all that?
Well, it starts so far back in South Central Los Angeles. When I first was there, I started having these images of people bursting apart, bursting into flame as they looked up into the sky.
You and Nostradamus?
Yes. Definitely.
I was working as a baker and getting up at 2 a.m. and driving through these streets with packs of wild dogs and people living under the freeways and trash can fires. It was just like the end of the world. It was already happening.
So at that point, you both decided to pull up stakes and go and live in the desert and do your art, right?
Well, I'd made the images. I've made carvings of people just ripping apart, angels falling with broken wings and images of martyrs. It was a slow process, and I didn't even know what was happening. I didn't even truly understand what I was doing. And then when Rachel and I met, she was doing images of the hunter-gatherers and of the hunt itself, of the actual sacrifice of the hunter and the hunted. And we knew we needed to get out of LA and move somewhere. At that point, we were leaving the city in order to survive momentarily and have a simple way of life.
And to live in beauty.
Well, to live closer to nature.
But now it seems as though all that has changed again. It's another moment of total transformation, just as that one was when I first met you.
Well, you actually asked that question when you were visiting us that time. And because we were saying how we didn't like the city and we never went anywhere, we never did anything, you actually said then, why do you live in the city? It was a great question, along with a lot of other things that happened to us at that time. And we started asking ourselves, what do we want to have learnt by the time we die? Certainly wasn't how to survive in Los Angeles.
And we weren't interested at all in the art world. It was the image itself and what this image was talking to us about, what it was trying to tell us.
I don't have any problem understanding that previous moment of passage when you left the urban environment and went off to the quiet atmosphere of the desert to make art. What is less clear since receiving your letter is why you're giving up that beautiful place you love and why you feel there's no time to make art anymore. And not only the decision not to make any more art, but then to destroy what you've already made and giving the rest away. I feel a sense of urgency behind all this, but I really don't know the story. What brought you to this point?
Well, it seemed to me, when you look at Rob's images, that they were about people bursting open at the moment of death, like seed cases ripping open as civilization cracks away. The images in my work were what would grow from that seed if it had a chance to grow. It was a new way of living with nature. something that's different from what culture provided. So we went out to live closer to nature, and we continue to make the same images. And we're surrounded there by meadowlarks and antelopes and an immense silence for 20 miles in every direction. Where we live, it's real open. And you can see for hundreds of miles in a couple of different directions. And you have this sense of the earth as a living being that is so immense. And you're working in your garden and you just turn your head a few degrees and you have infinity stretching out in front of you. It's like a vision quest place. And you live in a relationship to immensity long enough and you begin to drop away most of what you think is your personality and your culture. Because obviously culture doesn't matter at all in the great scope of the huge grand earth. And I think it's just lost its
allure.
It's lost its allure. And it's useless. It's all about separation. We went through a whole series of changes, just cleaning up the actual physical living of our lives. We got rid of the television, the VCR, the tape deck, and the microwave we were given as a gift. And we turned off our refrigerator 2.5 years ago because refrigerators are monuments to ill usage of energy on the planet. It's made out of chemicals that hurt the ozone. It is designed primarily for products of extractive agriculture. It's for dairy products. It's for meat. It is for the kind of vegetables that are raised on, shipped on trucks. And it's all quite recent.
So how do you manage in the desert without a refrigerator?
Well, we cook dried beans and dried rice. And we have a small greenhouse where we grow vegetables. And we have a garden outside for fresh vegetables, and we don't use much dairy. And we clarify the butter, and we make ghee, and that keeps for 4 months in hot weather. And people live for hundreds of thousands of years without refrigerators. You're not going to die if you turn the damn box off. Well, we had these two huge barns built for studios, and we camped in one. We put all our sculpture in the other. And we lived in one barn for 9 months while we built this little house. Then we moved into the little house. And the living of our life on the land became our art form. When we were in LA, and even before then, I lived my life for my art. I destroyed relationships, my body, my health, all kinds of things for the art. And that is the ideal of the artist in this culture. But living on the prairie in the context of the huge, larger nature that has nothing to do with culture, well, we started living life as an art. It's as if washing dishes, if done with presence, is as much of an art form as painting a picture or making a sculpture.
Did your desire to make the kind of art objects that you'd made before just dwindle and die out in you?
Well, it just faded away.
Well, actually, when we were first on the Rio Grande, we walked down to the river. And when I stopped there, I immediately thought, I'm never going to carve another piece of sculpture again.
What made that thought come to you then?
I have no idea. It was there. I knew it. I felt it. It wasn't just a thought.
In retrospect, you can't see what it was.
Not then. But I do now. Now I see that the art that I made in South Central Los Angeles was not art. It was a message to me.
Yeah.
It was like being shown visions that came in strange ways. They had to come through my hands.
So you feel you've got the message, mm-hmm. You've got the teaching from your own art. And what was the teaching?
The death of humanity, the death of our planet. The teaching was in terms of the hunter-gatherer. It was in regard to lost knowledge. Here are two homeless people standing outside at the point at which the earth is going to die. And one guy is just completely introverted. Doesn't see anything, doesn't even see the fire that's below his head. And the other guy is just ripped apart in his chest, just spreads apart, seeing that moment up in the sky. The shock of it. That's what I felt. But at that point, I just thought it was something to live with or to keep going in this society.
You mean how you carry the vision of apocalypse?
The more we lived on that land, the more we realised it is here. It's going to be very soon.
How did it come to you that it's so soon?
Well, we left LA because it felt like it could blow up. Well, the place that we lived in, I'm sure, burnt in the riots in the spring. A lot of your work, Rob, was about homelessness as a metaphor for spiritual homelessness. And you can't feel that level of disconnection that acutely without knowing that something is tremendously out of balance and that a system so divorced from what supports it is bound to collapse.
So the knowledge that everything is in a state of collapse or is already collapsing is what caused you to stop making art?
One thing about art is that, let's say that if we had another 40 years and we were to continue our careers, maybe some of that art would go out and be seen. But art takes years to come out, to go into the gallery system, to be written about, la-da-da-da.
There's no time.
There just wasn't time. That's what we felt. No time.
Well, art is also a closed world.
Yeah.
There's a small group of people who look at art and who think about art. It doesn't move out very far. The general populace may stand in line for Van Gogh, but the art world is a fairly closed little world.
Let's swing around to my generic question for these conversations. How do we live then in a time of decline or maybe even collapse? And what role does art have?
None.
None. None.
Well, for me, personally, making art was a powerful act. But it was a powerful act because I had no other access to anything more powerful. I had no access to making a daily life of prayer. If you can live your daily life as a prayer, it is inherently more powerful than going to your studio.
What would daily life like a prayer look like?
Well, daily life, like a prayer, is that everything is holy. You are holy. Everything around you is holy. Rinsing a vegetable in the sink is holy. But this is a quality that has been utterly lost from contemporary civilized society, which lives apart from nature. And it sees everything as dead except people. And the dead world is a lonely world. We live in an area where it's grassland and with that huge molten sky and the desert. You know that nature is alive and you hear one of those thunderstorms coming and you know that that's alive. And it's like when you step on the grass, you have to thank the grass because you are stepping on it. You have to say, excuse me. This is a kind of living that is so alien to us. It takes a lot of work to be that reverent and we're a long way from it, but I have an inkling of what I would like it to be.
Joseph Campbell once said, "We don't want to understand life. We want to experience it as richly as we possibly can."
That's it. But I have no interest in documenting it. I have no interest in presenting it as art. I have no interest in even calling it art. My interest is in living it.
So the price of re-enchantment is direct experience. You've set out to live the implications of your vision, which is breaking your cultural beliefs, and is taking you beyond the traditional path of the artist.
Right. Well, we went to a lot of trouble to get rid of a lot of toxic things in our environment. We still have our car, and that's a tough one. We got rid of the refrigerator, we got rid of the camera, we gave it away because we didn't want to use photochemicals anymore to promote ourselves. And that's the end of your art career right there if you have no more camera. Another thing is what I would call a toxic ego. And you were asked to have a degree of separation and personal identity as an artist in this culture that is just as toxic as a refrigerator. I had trouble with that. I handled it badly when I had one.
Hopefully you handled your refrigerator better.
Well, I didn't want to have a toxic ego anymore. I wanted to be separated from the separation. And I wanted to go back to being part of a larger family of living beings rather than having to peek in through the window. I was tired of making symbols about something that I knew had to be true. I want to live it instead.
You've shifted worlds from chronicler to participant.
Well, that's why we finally decided to take the wilderness survival classes with Tom Brown and learn the actual ancient skills of living with the earth, the ancient reverence, daily life skills of the hunter-gatherer.
You wanted to do something to break the patterning of your own thinking, to experience a form of reality other than a particular form of cultural trance.
Well, we just recently learned things that any 8-year-old Neanderthal five-year-old person would know.
We are more ignorant than a 5-year-old Neanderthal child.
We are so ignorant. And between the two of us, we have 4 degrees.
Hey, wait a minute, let's be fair. We're ignorant because those things have not been relevant to the lifestyles and set of behaviours that we use in modern life.
Well, that's why we are here in this place of feeling the end of the earth, because we don't use those skills. Mm. And the skills were not just physical, they were spiritual.
What is it you learnt from the tracker?
Well, he guarantees that after just the standard class, you can survive anywhere in North America, any season, any terrain, with nothing. No equipment, not even a knife. But survival is just the beginning. For him, it's an opening for another way of being. The skills and knowledge enable you to live so directly with the earth that you can experience completely that your life comes from the earth.
One of the things he teaches is that if you go through learning these physical skills and start to become more aware of your world, you will really get an understanding that you will never hurt the earth again. You won't take the earth for granted. It's not just a physical way of surviving out there in the wilderness. It brings you further into being a part of all the things that are there. We've been reading Brown's books ever since Los Angeles, and we tried to do the things that were in his books all through those years when we were living in the desert.
So you're de-escalating from technology, something that came out of reading him?
No, not that. He never said anything like that.
Well, he was teaching ways of walking, ways of opening your vision, the dynamics of meditative looking and moving into the landscape, where your perception comes out from the landscape rather than at it. But at the same time as we were losing some of the accoutrements of civilization, we were adding in what little bit we could figure out of the ancient skills from the books. For instance, we made fires from a bow drill that we constructed from special sticks that we found in the woods. You create friction by working the bow drill, and then with a little bit of dried grass and sunshine for tinder, you blow on it until it bursts into flames. And you make fire with your own breath, and it's incredibly magical. It's primary magic. Well, at one point, we got some cow tendons to make a sinew-backed bow. And tendons are really good in a survival situation. They make the strongest cordage that you can come by. And they are really powerful. And they come from the part of the muscle that provides the tension on joints. And we went to the slaughterhouse to get a few tendons to dry in order to learn about this material. But the only way you could buy them in Albuquerque was by the 25-pound box.
An Achilles tendon. Only Achilles tendons.
Who the hell uses Achilles tendons?
The Japanese. They eat them. And no one knows how. So we bought this 25-pound box of Achilles tendons home, and they're very rubbery and tough. And so they're very scary to clean with a knife because it's really easy to slip off them. And they were from cows, and they weren't clean.
What did you do with them?
Well, first we dried them, and then we tried to make a sinew-backed bow.
As in bow and arrow? A bow you can use to shoot game animals with in the hunt?
Uh-huh. Yeah, to learn how to do it.
Did you bring the bow to the tracking class? Did you show it to Brown?
No. He doesn't want to see it.
Well, also, it didn't really work.
Why no?
It didn't work? How many tendons did you use to make this bow?
Oh, 6 or 7.
What did you do with the other 20?
Well, we used them in a sculptor class I gave for a couple of weeks. I handed them out.
To make sculptures?
Well, I showed the students how to make cordage out of them by pounding out the fibres. And, you know, when we first told our friends in LA, in the art world, that we were giving up our work, that we were giving it away, we got a lot of letters back.
What kind of responses did you get?
Well, from some of the art people, a horrible response. And for others, really great support. One of the things that I notice with some artists is that there is this horror that life outside of art is hideous, so appalling and dismal that the only thing that gives one hope is being in the studio. And all I could say was that when we first decided to cut loose and really give this stuff weight, all kinds of things started happening to us, opportunities and new people. And we've met more new people since we decided to put our house on the market and give the art away than we've met in probably years, just in a couple of months. And it felt like that sense of discovery and newness and unexpectedness and vitality that I always associated with studio time is now lifetime. And when we first decided to sell the house, we decided to be really quiet about what we were up to. And we were very vague, for instance, with the real estate ladies about what we were doing. And then also the people that we bought the land from. But then at a certain point,
we started talking.
Well, it just seemed to us that it was more important to say, I mean, the world, the earth is dying. Human beings have to change how they live with the earth. And they have to change it soon. It felt like it was more important to say that. If people thought we were weird, then it was okay. But more people have said, gee, what I think what you're doing is wonderful. I wouldn't have the courage personally, but I am glad you're doing it. And when we finally came out of the closet...
Are you actually planning to totally leave the money culture then and live without money?
The basic plan is to sell the house and pay off the mortgage, and then we're just going to live someplace as simply as we can. We've already put a lot of deposits down on Tom Brown's classes. Even before we went to the first one, we had this feeling that this was it. We've also realised that you don't need all this stuff that we live with today. You don't need to have a mortgage, to have a house that keeps you warm. You don't need to have this infrastructure in order to have food. There is enough food in the wild to feed us if we are able to live with the earth. So we've got a lot of classes to learn, as many as he's going to allow us to take, and then we'll just keep the rest and live simply and...
practice the skills. Mm.
He calls it dirt time.
Mm. You find tracks and you follow them. We all went outside and we did it. We even saw deer tracks in the gravel. And this is after just 1 week of being exposed to the concept, of being exposed to the fact that you can see these things, that they exist out there. You don't even need a clear track in the mud. That's why I say it's like art. It's like pattern recognition. I'd heard for years that in other cultures, the things that are now called art in this culture were part of daily life. And this is one doorway into that. And tracking utilises a huge amount of what art has been about. Only it's not a specialised separate activity. It's something that allows you to be closer to nature and to realise that it all comes from nature. It all comes from the earth. And we just rearrange things obsessively. And now we see tracks everywhere.
Yes, and everybody can learn how to do it. It's amazing. But you do have to do dirt time.
Dirt time means putting your nose to the ground. I was just looking at his book here, the one we bought earlier, and it says, this book deals with the many reasons that one should come out of wilderness and why. The decision to leave a life of purity and enter a world that is impure and remove from spiritual rapture is one of the most difficult choices a person must make in his or her life. The question I'm most often asked by students is, how can I take what I've learned here in wilderness, take it back to society? How can I continue to live with what I found in the purity of creation? I guess my question is, how is being able to recognise whether the deer had a full or empty bladder when it passed by, how is that going to help you live in society today?
Tracking is not one thing. It's a part of awareness and being aware of our world.
Most people's lives as they're currently being lived don't have any deer or deer tracks.
You'll find tracks anywhere. One thing that Brown did for a number of years was to stalk in New York City. Mm. He would hide in the crevices, in the little corners of buildings in the city, and he watched homeless people. He watched people going to work. He watched everybody.
Foxes, raccoons.
He watched people going to work and he watched foxes at the same time.
At night, he saw foxes. He'd follow snakes or possums in the city. He said he found all kinds of things. Of course, that's one of the skills that you are taught at the school, stalking. And all of that is a part of awareness. You can't stalk without being aware of everything else around you.
So what you're really trying to do is to use your brain differently.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Get out of that pattern of focused, fixed vision. Mm. This exists in space in front of me. I know what it is. I know where it is. Rather, that this is movement. Flick of tail out of the corner of your eye. And when you shift like that, you can catch all kinds of things at the corner. And the thing about the full bladder and the deer is, well...
How is that relevant to modern life?
Well, it's the idea that other creatures are living and complex. If you can look at a single deer track and notice that the deer paused, notice that the deer turned, what it might have looked at, whether it was troubled or whether it's at ease, it allows you to extend what I would call your heart out to that creature.
That shamanic vision. I guess that's what, when they say that the shaman becomes the animal, becomes the tree.
Exactly, really becomes it. It's a participatory world.
Brown says that as you go along in tracking, if you really get into it, you will be able to see the deer make that track.
Mm.
So in a sense, this is developing the deepest level of empathy.
Yes, very definitely. And that's the irony of it, because a lot of environmental people probably would be horror-stricken if I say I want to learn to hunt. But the thing is, if you have to viscerally take a life to support your own life, well, you're hardly going to go out and do it excessively. I mean, if you feel it, if you really feel the gift of another life, you're only going to take it when you absolutely need it. And you're going to make sure that you utilize absolutely everything about it to honor the spirit.
Are you putting all that you have spiritually and economically and psychologically into these tracking courses in order to learn these feelings then, or to actually try and live this life?
To learn the skills that go with the feelings, which to some extent we've already accessed in some ways on our own. I mean, well, we came to this with an affinity for it.
And someday to live it.
When you say live it, do you want to live the life of the hunter-gatherer?
Yes, yes. Actually, I would love more than anything to be allowed to do it. Well, we got to the point in the book where it says, you have to come back into society and try to help. And we said, oh God, oh shit, do we have to? I mean, selling the house has put us back into society. Giving the art away has put us back into society. And we were very comfortable out there living without anybody around.
What was it, economic pressure or spiritual pressure that drove you out?
It was spiritual pressure. We wanted to learn more than we could have just from reading the books.
It's interesting because when I started these conversations, I didn't have anything more in mind than let's do this. Let's open up this dialogue as a way of blending energy. But already certain things are beginning to come through. It's Mindell's time spirit idea. Mm. You can become a vehicle for certain things that need to be said just by opening yourself up and allowing the conversation to take place. You let the spirits talk through you and take you to that place where the forbidden communication stops being forbidden.
Well, as an artist, you always think that you have to have a product. So as soon as it wasn't going to be a sculpture, it became very convenient to tell our family and friends that we were going to write a book, because they would understand that. And there was this terror that we wouldn't be doing something that was along that line. But the kind of interactions that we have had with people just since starting to sell the house and talking to the people that we gave the pieces to, it seems that human face-to-face communication is, well, I wouldn't call it our art form, but it's apparently what we do now. And we live in a culture where most of the information comes removed. It's from movies, television, and books. Whereas, say, almost all of the wisdom in the Upanishads say that you must have direct communication with the master. And you can't learn this without a direct transmission from another human being. Well, to some extent, we have lost direct transmission in our culture. Talking only to one person, it's not enough. You must reach 10,000 people or 40,000 people or whatever. But suddenly now, a conversation with friends, it's like spreading pollen.
There's also the living quality that James Hillman talks about. Talking is a living art. You allow for the interruptions and unexpected turns, and you don't try to monitor or edit. You can be artful afterwards somewhat in how you shape it, but what you don't want to lose is the vibrancy of the moment, the intensity of the conversation has, that's very different from something that has been thought about over time and then written down. Conversation has another quality. I never imagined that even a writer could work interactively in this way.
Well, it's a lot like tracking. You don't know at first what is ahead on the trail. Brown's teacher, Stalking Wolf, whom he called grandfather, said that the ground is like a manuscript, constantly being rewritten by the movement of feet, wind, rain, and leaves, instead of by letters. One of the main reasons that we are so interested in working with Brown is that what he inherited from grandfather is not culture specific. It's more the essence of what some of the Native American cultures were about. And grandfather was an Apache, but he wandered alone for 60 years up and down all of North America on foot. And he met and he studied with a lot of people, elders from many different tribes. But we have put together a kind of essential core of the spiritual attitude without all of the custom laid over it. And as we got rid of our art, one of the biggest things that we were doing by stepping away was letting go of external symbols and going for the energy at the core. And what Brown presents is just the core of that reverent attitude. And he has a quote in one of his books it's a Chinese proverb. And it says, seek not the ways of the men of old, seek instead what they sought. But it's that idea of going to the essential human skills for living, the basic reverent skills of living truly with the earth that we're after, rather than try to, say, jump into a whole other culture. And we have to have the right skills in order to live simply from the heart without propping ourselves up. Without all of the things that have become so destructive. Well, in many ways, learning these skills is essentially a prayer that you're offering, a prayer that this becomes a way of life again on the earth.
Hunter-gatherers are the apex of human civilization, and we need to go back to that point. All else is a bastardization and a plague. We can't assume what is comfortable for society. Pick and choose. You've got to do it all the way or not at all, or we die.
Before we move into the interval, we've got about 15 minutes, an opportunity for any questions or any comments, either about the process itself or the content of the interview. But before we do that, just thought it might be a good idea if we just briefly introduce ourselves. So my name's Fern Smith, and I'm one of the co-founders of Volcano. And I was the one that found the transcript and was drawn to do it as one of my contributions to the birthday party festival. That's all I'll say.
My name's Phil Ralph, and I'm an associate artist with Volcano, and a performer and a writer, and I am actually Fern's partner. So I got roped in.
And my name is Lucy Neal, and I feel I'm in a bit of a time-space continuum at the moment. I'm just saying goodbye to being Susie Gablick, who is somebody who I've never met, but I've admired her writings very much indeed. So I'm somewhere in that desert with the cow tendons. But I'm Lucy Neal. I'm a theatre maker, in essence, and I find myself right at this moment, and I'm actually writing a book. And so Susie's last comment about not realising that as a writer you could in fact find yourself in these very sort of live, interactive dialogues, and that itself is part of a very rich process or practice, and that's pretty much where I am at the moment. I've been very involved in the Transition Town movement lately, which is a grassroots collective response to some of these great big stories of economy and ecology and challenge that we live with. But being essentially from an arts practice, I found myself thinking, well, what if we tried to gather together some of the emergent practices that artists are putting their hands to, cow tendons and all, and try to see what patterns are there. Is there something like a transitional arts practice? And that's pretty much where I am at the moment. Mm-hmm. And very honoured to have done this.
So it's really clear about the process of how we went about doing that.
Oh, we should also say that this is the seventh time that we have done doing Dirt Time as part of the birthday party, and each time it's been done, we have
a
different interviewer, a different Susie Gablick. And the person who that we've asked to come in and join us in some way, we've asked them because they work in the arts and that their work is some way tuning in with the themes that are coming out of the interview. And the person has never, Lucy, you knew the book, but mostly people haven't read the book, haven't seen the interview, definitely haven't heard it. So this is the first time that actually that people get it in their ears and speak simultaneously. So, well done. It's quite a very odd process. And actually taking the things out, all of a sudden you keep waiting for the big voice in your head to tell you what to say for a little while afterwards. So it's quite a jump to come back into normal life. So
you two know what you're saying?
No, we're getting it the same as...
You're repeating as well?
Yeah.
So from an acting point of view, how does that change how you feel on stage? I mean, just, does it make you less feel natural, or, does it separate you from the text?
The fact that the words are being fed to us in their own time.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, first of all, the initial kind of response to that, how it makes you feel.
Well, I suppose it's kind of, obviously it's the seventh time we've done it, so even though we don't know it yet, because, you haven't got time, we're still a lot more relaxed than we were the first time we did it. But even so, as you can see, Lucy did it brilliantly, and it feels like you're just thinking the thoughts as they're coming to you, and it feels, I think when you watch it, it feels very natural. But the process of doing it from the inside is rather like the sort of, the performance equivalent of doing that.
Air
traffic
control.
Yeah, it's very odd, isn't it?
But I guess that goes with the whole interview being quite anxious anyway, so it's good to have that anxious.
Yes, yeah, so it adds a sort of...
I felt that actually, that at quite a visceral level, the very practical task of listening and speaking and tracking, it is tracking, comprehension, because you can say a word and a word and a word and a word, but somewhere you need to throw in some sense of what the sentence might add up to, particularly because these are big philosophical subjects that are being looked at, but having to do it tiptoeing word at a time, that tension I felt did come through in terms of the urgency of what these two artists, where they're at, and they're on an edge, gulping up all this big story, but trying to find a daily way of living. I found that urgency did come through from the form we were doing it in.
Yes.
Because you can't get behind. If you get behind, you're lost. So you have to... Sometimes you get behind in the thought and you have to...
You have to shut down your own internal dialogue to be able to listen. Which, in a way, they, you know, you're saying about the death of the ego, they're stripping themselves of their ego. And in a way it kind of parallels that, because you have to completely shut yourself down in order to deliver the word. So that's interesting.
Whilst at the same time you can't lose yourself in what's happening, because if you know, I don't speak as much as Fern, but so I spend a fair bit of time sort of looking and nodding and things. But if I lose it, and all of a sudden I've got my head in my voice in my head, oh, it's me, you know. So it's you've really got to kind of stay on it, but kind of not anywhere at the same time. It's very odd.
Yeah.
A direct. I mean, I suppose they talk about this direct transmission from the master. That's what they talk about, isn't it? Direct transmission.
Like when you're taking. Channeling.
Channeling from the iPod.
Channeling gabbling.
Channeling gabbling. And it's the book. The interview comes from this book, Susie Gablick's book, Conversations Before the End of Time. And she says a little bit later in the interview about when she set out on this journey of interviewing different people, and they're mainly artists that she talks to or arts commentators, about really the role of the arts and artists in society at this moment that we're at now. And you really see this sense that the conversation becomes the art form in a way. So, Conversations Before the End of Time, it's the transcript published in that book, and also The Reenchantment of Art was published before that, and that's where she really talks about, I suppose, her grand ideas, really. And she's in her 70s now, I think, and it's really good that she knows that we're doing it, and we're doing this with her blessing. And that actually felt very important, because sometimes volcanoes do get into trouble. Doing, you know, kind of going, oh, we'll do it and we won't tell anyone. But we thought it was really important that she knew. And of course, you risk someone saying, well, we don't want you to do it then.
But you're continuing the dialogue, aren't you? So you're just furthering her work in a way, aren't you?
Well, that's hopefully what,
What I felt is what she's doing is that the reason she's kind of pushing in her questions to them, what she's pushing on is her own belief, really. That actually art does have a purpose, that by acknowledging that I'm alive on this planet in daily life, you can have responsibility, you can have ethical, moral, and she would argue ecological responsibilities, and somewhere in that exploration she argues very, very well that is the reenchantment of art, that it is simply our rehearsing in a daily way this sense of ourselves and how we connect and how, you know, we are a nurturing force, really, in terms of the quality of life. So they are giving her a real run for her money on that. And I think that's why she goes to such lengths to try to really kind of get under their skin. And of course, I'm completely fascinated by where these two are, really, whether they still don't have a refrigerator.
So the interview was happened in 1992.
The brown is taking money from them to do classes.
That's true.
So. Brown, yeah. I mean, often there is that sense of, what's it, like a dana or something like that. It almost seems a gift exchange. It's funny, I don't have a difficulty about that at all, going actually that there is something about valuing something. I mean, I know that different teachers do say that they can't give away their skills for money. But I think it's a complex one, isn't it? And also, I suppose, in terms of monetary value, you know, kind of a sense of actually how we value things in terms of hard currency or not hard currency. I think there is always a currency involved in exchange, whether it's pounds and punts or not.
And we instinctively, you know, if somebody's making money from something, we instinctively go, well, they're a bit of a snake oil salesman, you know.
There's making money and then there's profiting. Though,
yeah,
isn't
it's that difficult balance.
It's just
it?
A symbol for what you can exchange it for, but then there's so... If you take a skill from someone and then money is exchanged, that just represents, so it means you can buy specific food rather than them giving you the food directly.
Yeah.
Rather than making profits, then having excess money, so then you're...
Isn't the problem with like the self-indulgence and the fact that you you as your character was in a position where you had that money and you had the freedom to be able to give that money, where a lot of people who maybe would want to do that couldn't.
Mm. Yeah, that's the speak about them having to go back into society to share what they've learned. Mm. That's what they were struggling with, but that's what needs to happen so that they can then further their learning.
Do you want to know where they are now?
Yeah.
Where are they now?
Suicide.
Do you know?
Yeah. They actually, they're called Rob and Rachel Olds now, rather than Dutton and Olds. And they're actually continuing this work, and I think that they're probably in their late 60s, early 70s, mid 70s. In a way, I suppose, carrying on the work, really.
But they had gone for 20 years, and when Fern first showed me this interview 2 years ago, and we went, I wonder where they are, and you put them into Google, and the only thing that came up was this interview.
Mm. So again, that thing about tracing and tracks, that kind of felt interesting.
And then when we were preparing for this, you looked again and you found their website, which is them doing Brown's work.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Could you mention,
Mindell?
Yes, Mindell's Dreamtime.
And James Hillman is
mentioned. Mm. Yeah, so Hillman is a Jungian analyst, I think, and...
That's about the soul, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And Mindell's process-oriented psychology. And he brought together kind of shamanistic practices and psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. So both of them extraordinary commentators, really. Yeah.
Just a few more minutes left.
Yeah.
Curious about the process, you know, how you, on the one hand, you are portraying these characters that want to detach themselves from culture, although they may fail at some points, you know, the money issue and so on, and then being involved yourselves with technology, you know, with the iPods, and this sort of contradiction. Mm. You know, on the one hand, this discourse that is all about, you know, living with the earth, and on the other time, on the other hand, you having to have all the words fed by this iPod, and how this dichotomy play for you.
Mm. Yeah, it's a paradox, and I suppose that was what intrigued me about this. I read it, and I just immediately went, God, this. I just thought it was so extraordinary what they were saying. That it just felt like, it was almost like I wanted to, you know, when you have a book and you want to give it to everybody. So in a way, this was almost like my version of going, let's give it to everybody, this book. And I was interested in almost dressing it up in technology. So it was a choice putting it in this room as well. So really presenting the paradox that we're living in, the kind of almost like the draw of stepping away and the pull of staying with. And that moment where we are at the moment of having to make choices in our lives, really, what we strip away and what we feel like, I can't live out. Like they say, the car, that's a hard one. And of course, you know, we say, I'll get rid of everything. But my iPhone, I can't get rid of that. So I think it was something that, we said that we could have done it where the three of us sat around with the book and just read it to people. Mm. But there's almost, it's problematizing some of the issues that they're talking about as well.
I think the other contradiction, which I find really interesting, is I can't remember, unfortunately, who said it, but talking about script, and that one of the real challenges we have at the moment is that we don't really have a script. You know, and as humans, we quite like having to know the story we're in. And we really don't really know the story we're in at the moment. So there's an awful lot of experimenting and making it up and denying that we don't have a script. And so the kind of electric script that we had tonight was kind of following a script like this and against your nose. And I found that a very interesting contradiction. We don't really have a script, but we're just going to say these words here because it's written down and we can kind of repeat them in such a way that we might open the space up. That kind of let some of this kind of energy in about which path, which track, you know, what's right, what's wrong, what feels best, what feels pointless, you know, who's to say?
I was also particularly intrigued tonight when they were talking about we gave away our cameras and we don't want to make any more work. We've got two cameras recording this tonight because we want to. We must document. So there was sort of quadruple irony going on.
Yeah, that's what they say, the idea of being being given this script, isn't it? It isn't this idea of technology, you know, being fed information a little bit all the time. Whereas, you know, there is, on the other hand, you're talking about trying to interpret drugs, you know, being a much more active role with life. You know, this is what it seems to be the argument of these people. But on the other hand, you're experiencing this other situation, which is, you know, very passive. You're being given this script almost. You're just having to repeat that, which it seems sometimes what we are going through with technology at once.
But can I, just to state the complete obvious, I do think that the theatre is a very brilliant place to be able to just gather and to see what happens when you kind of make a story up as you go along, and there's an audience and the participants, and we're all kind of in it together in that moment. And I would never want to overlook the importance of this very place that we're in. That feels as though it's got a lot of keys.
That's a really nice place to wrap that up. So we've now got a half an hour interval. So for those of you that haven't had a chance to look around the exhibition, please do. In the corrugated iron space on the left-hand side, as you make your way out, there is a little door. And for this half an hour, in some slots, there is an empathy booth in there. If you're interested in going in there, it's one at a time, and not everybody will be able to do it, but that's there. There's also, there are documents that you can have. There are copies of this document, the emergence document, which is a record of 3 daily one-day conferences that Fern and Volcano organised about